Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to the Goddard Report. Comments made on the Goddard Report and TalkDigitalNetwork.com are an expression of opinion only. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Brad Nickerson. He's running as the People's Party of Canada candidate in the riding of Burnaby North Seymour in British Columbia. You can follow him on Twitter at BNickerson12. Brad, welcome to the Goddard Report.
Thank you. I've heard so many good things about your show, and I just started listening to it myself, and I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
I was born and raised on the northwest coast of British Columbia in a fishing town called Prince Rupert, just south of the Alaska Panhandle. So had background of hunting and fishing and building tree forts and getting into nothing but mischief. At a time in history where your parents didn't really care what you got into just as long as they didn't get a call from the police or the hospital. And moved down to the Lower Mainland, like so many, and to attend university and just never left. So I've lived in North Burnaby, which is the southern half of the district of Burnaby North Seymour, for basically the balance of my life.
What made you run in this election?
Quite frankly, it was the government's policies surrounding their COVID response was the critical factor. I've always been an avid follower of politics, both nationally and internationally. But I became very, very concerned early on about whether or not they had a valid predicate for the extraordinary measures that they were taking. And I came to the conclusion fairly early on, no later than the end of April of 2020, that they did not. The epidemiological data simply did not support the measures they were taking, and there just seemed to be an awful lot of what I would call deception going on the part of various levels of government. And so I tried the appropriate approach first. I wrote my local member of parliament, and I expressed my concerns, and I'm providing graphs and sources and citations and what have you. And I got a polite response, but it did not address any of my questions. And then I made some predictions for some friends about what I thought was going to happen next. And the bottom line for me was the vaccine passports. That was the line in the sand. I'd seen it coming. And when I heard Prime Minister Trudeau make his first indications that he was kind of looking at directing the country in that direction, I decided that I would likely make my stand, and the only way to do it was through politics.
Those questions you asked your MP, what were some of them?
Why are you doing what you're doing when the epidemiological evidence does not support either that it is necessary, required, or appropriate? And why are you doing it when it doesn't, in fact, do what you claim you say it's going to do? Because we did have a subject population, and we had control groups in other parts of the world. So you had countries like Sweden, for example, and another one that most people don't know about is South Korea, did not impose these measures and simply relied upon voluntary measures. And by and large, the epidemiology, given the various national factors, was not all that different between those those countries that did lock down and those that didn't. In fact, it was much worse in a number of the places where they went into full hard lockdown. In fact, there's no real correlation between how hard the lockdowns were and what the actual outcomes were. It seems to have much more to do with overall public health policy than anything else. So when I did that, I decided to put together a newsletter for some close colleagues and associates about what I thought was really going on, and put together a fairly large library of archived material that I've now also been able to rely on in my political campaign, because I've got a lot of information more or less right at my fingertips.
The BC government's instituting vaccine passports 1 week prior to the federal election. Why aren't they waiting until after the election?
Well, that's a very good question. The only question that might be a better question is why they're doing it at all. I actually put that question to Premier Horgan in a Twitter thread that I put together shortly after that was announced. And I then, went through, and people who wanted to go to my Twitter thread at bnickerson12 on Twitter, they can read it. It's a few tweet threads down. And I then showed the actual evidence, evidence that these measures were simply not required. And also I believe that it's a fundamental abridgment of our rights to privacy. I've worked in and around litigation for close to 30 years. If you want access to my personal medical history, ask me questions about it, then you need to get a court order from a judge, and you must show cause. And that is usually a part of an underlying legal action. Or I can sign a voluntary authorization and disclose my medical records to you, including vaccination history. So I'm not entirely sure that what they're doing here is lawful. And what I have been doing very carefully is I've been looking at the public health orders that have been emanating from the Ministry of Health of British Columbia, and comparing that to what powers are in fact given to the Ministry under the Public Health Act for these public health orders. And I'm not of the view that much of what they've been doing is lawful.
We've heard the COVID virus has not been properly isolated anywhere in the world. What have you heard?
I'm agnostic on that issue. I have looked at some of the studies where it was claimed that it was isolated, and I've read critiques of those studies. And the one in particular that I've read is out of the South Korean CDC. It's not a position that I'm taking right now. I think we would need something a little more independent rather than critiques of what have been done. But I regard it as an open issue, but it's not something that I believe is constructive to pursue at this time.
What are your thoughts on the PCR test?
I think the PCR test is not fit for purpose in terms of how it's being applied. I think that for those who know what a PCR test, it was invented by Dr. Gary Mullis. He won a Nobel Prize and the Japan Science Prize for it. It's how we ended up getting DNA testing. And he was sort of the Darwin of modern biology. And he said himself, when he was asked these questions, when his PCR test was being used to test for, viral load, effectively is what they call it, that you have to be very careful with this, because if you run it at too high a cycle count, so every time you run a sample, it's a logarithmic increase. It's not one, then two, then three. And there's very clear indication that many labs have been running their PCR cycle counts far too high. Fauci himself has, in a recorded interview, said that anything over 35 and all you're getting is dead nucleotides. Meaning to say is that whatever is coming there is not an indication of could be useful in terms of determining infection with anything. Most labs in Canada are using cycle counts over 35. Some is in British Columbia at 35 to 40, according to one study, 37 in Ontario, 38 in Quebec, and I've seen some numbers as high as 40. We don't really know because they're not releasing that data, but there was a study released in the summer of 2020 that addressed that. So, and the notion that you would diagnose somebody with a potentially, serious infectious disease simply based upon a PCR test is quite frankly ridiculous. You still have to do a clinical examination. Are they presenting, for example, with symptoms? And is there indication of illness? So if you combine the fact that the test itself is not fit for purpose, it's not designed to diagnose infectious disease, that it was running at two high cycle counts, and they were testing healthy people that were showing no clinical signs of illness. That started to make one very concerned about what was really going on here. Because if I know this, then presumably the people in charge of the BC Ministry of Health and Health Canada actually know this as well. So what's going on?
Are lockdowns more dangerous than the feared virus?
There is data to indicate that they are. There is a well-known concept known as diseases of despair. Harvard University has done a number of studies in this area that unemployment, isolation lead to higher rates of maladaptive behavior. This includes increased alcohol use as well as increased drug abuse, as well as depression, suicide, family violence, and a variety of things. And this in turn leads to higher mortality. The studies were originally done in terms of those industrial areas of North America that have been affected by deindustrialization. And there is a study that I've read that indicates that while there was an increase in all-cause mortality in Canada in 2020, the demographic that was affected the most was males under the age of 40. And I think that was a study co-authored by Dennis Ranicor. And males under 40 were relatively unaffected by COVID. And so it was suggestive that it was an increase in mortality due to the lockdowns themselves. We're having public policy being driven by, public health policy being driven by anecdote. You hear stories, sad stories about people who have been affected by a respiratory syndrome. And COVID is a syndrome, which is a constellation of symptoms that fall within a diagnostic umbrella as well as rather than a description of a given disease. And most people don't know that how many people actually in British Columbia died last year, died of COVID, or diagnosed, had been tested positive for COVID, and so they died with COVID is the term that's applied. It was about 901. Almost twice as many people died of illicit drug overdoses, and that number had effectively doubled in 2020 over in 2019, and you can actually watch the spike in overdose cases following the lockdowns. Clear, explicit, statistical, you know, grim data. Drug overdoses were twice those. Mortality from drug overdoses was twice that of COVID in 2020.
Is the wearing of face masks made in China a health risk?
I think the wearing of face masks, period, is a health risk unless there's some proper clinical purpose to you wearing them. They inhibit your body's absorption of oxygen. They inhibit and impair breathing. And the World Health Organization, as of February, March 2020, told you not to wear them because they could actually lead to the spread of infection. And then something changed rapidly and radically for some reason in the fall of 2020. And that's never been adequately explained why all of a sudden 100 years of our understandings of how we control respiratory viruses goes out the window, and all of a sudden we're forcing masks on children. There's a lot to account to for here. I advocate that once some sane and sensible governance returns to this country, that we need a full public inquiry to find out exactly what happened here, and bring those who knew what they were doing was wrong to account.
Do you see a path for Maxime Bernier to become Prime Minister later this month?
I see a gossamer thread, but with the debate commission's decision not to allow him to participate in the debates so the Canadians could actually see him, foreclosed that possibility. And I think that was a distinctly political decision by what is supposed to be a nonpartisan organization.
Do you think it's an unfair decision by the debate commission, considering that the People's Party is polling much better than the Green Party?
Absolutely, yes. And they knew what they were doing, they just didn't care. That was completely out of line, and they know it. And they don't want the Canadian people taking a good look at Maxime Bernier, because the other candidates' leaders would pale in comparison. They're relying upon their their information operations, which is the modern word for propaganda, and people's lack of knowledge about the People's Party of Canada and Maxime Bernier in order to suppress their vote. As it is, I also think that there's weighting being done with the polls that also indicates is not fully reflecting the support that the party has in the country. As you know, polls are very easy to manipulate according to the weighting factors in terms of age, socioeconomic status, and what have you. You can come up with different answers depending on how you're doing your weighting, and that's how they make the sausage, and they rarely disclose that.
Should people be looking into ways to boost their immune systems to keep COVID and other bugs away?
Well, people should be looking for ways to be healthy all the time, always. Getting regular exercise, obviously the role of vitamin D in proper metabolic function is well documented, but I won't need to speak to that here. Avoiding sugars and starchy carbohydrates and watching one's weight, staying within a reasonable weight for your age and your height. These are all good recommendations. And it's curious, of course, that hard lockdowns are prevented people from actually doing the kind of things that kept them healthy.
We'll have more with Brad Nickerson right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Brad Nickerson. Brad, what do you think is planned for the COVID project going forward?
Well, here we're speculating, and I believe it was Yogi Berra that said that making predictions is really hard, especially about the future. There seems to be almost a manic desire to get every living human soul in the country vaccinated, and for which they will then be provided with a vaccine passport then to allow them to act to travel and to access general society. There is discussions that would easily then transmit into a form of digital ID for every individual as your universal passport through society. And that is on the speculative, plausible side. What is not speculative is that the world's central banks, including Canada's, are moving rapidly towards a digital currency. What most people do not know, because this time they did a much better job of basically covering it up, is that the financial system began to collapse in September of 2019. And by the end of the year, it was blinking red. And the same problem as 2008, 2009, only much worse this time because the level of leverage was even higher, and there were fewer stop gaps in the way to prevent an implosion. Now, most people don't know that happened, because COVID happened, and that's been the focus of the attention of the media ever since. But behind the scenes, they're moving full speed ahead with the introduction of central bank digital currencies. And there's the question of then what happens to, are these going to be complementary to physical currency, or is it going to be, is it going to replace them? And the Bank of Canada issued a policy paper in, I believe, February of 2020, where they were looking at this because they were concerned about other monetary sovereign countries would be introducing central bank digital currencies, including China, and that they would lose control of their own currency regime if they didn't follow suit. So that could be the reason, but the question of whether or not they're moving forward with central bank digital currencies is not a controversial one.
Would the People's Party put an end to the COVID project in Canada?
Our leader, Maxime Bernier, has made it very clear he does not support lockdowns as a control measure for COVID, and that the party does not support the application of vaccine passports in order to fully engage with general society.
What percentage of people are intelligent?
I don't know. Intelligence takes many forms. we're all put on this earth for a reason by the Creator. But we have to find our purpose on our own. The mechanic who recently replaced the front end suspension on my car has probably never read Nietzsche, German philosopher, but he sure knows his way around a car. And there are those of us who have certain capabilities that may involve higher rates of, say, literacy or analysis, but I don't regard somebody who has strong practical knowledge to be unintelligent, because they very clearly are not. The problem that I encountered over the last 18 months in trying to talk to a number of my friends and colleagues and associates is not so much intelligence as this troubled thing called an ego. And that seems to be what's getting in the way. Where people who consider themselves to be of above average intelligence don't believe that they could be someone who could fall victim to a propaganda effort. They don't think that they could be misled. And it's that group, that the people who still believe that the system would never do such a thing, who think that the system is still, despite what we've observed in the last 18 months, is somehow operating normally. I think they need to get their egos out of the way and start seeing with the light of day that what we've experienced in the last 18 months is absolutely astonishing. And the fact that there was never a valid medical public health predicate for what's been done is terrifying.
Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030, the Great Reset, where apparently you'll own nothing and be happy about it. Former Conservative Prime Minister Brian Mulroney signed Canada onto Agenda 21. Former Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper signed Canada onto Agenda 2030. Liberal Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, along with other world leaders, have been implementing those agendas. Could these agendas and the extreme debt loads taken on by consumers and homeowners, along with the Trudeau government's out-of-control spending spree, be designed to bankrupt Canada and the people of Canada in time for 2030?
Well, Agenda 2030 is simply a UN initiative. There's nothing secret or conspiratorial about it. And it fits within an agenda in terms of most of the G7 countries moving away from carbon-intensive economies. Now, the baton has been picked up by the World Economic Forum, and they've become sort of the chief public relations arm of the program, let's call it that. Now, the question of whether or not there has been an effort to somehow bankrupt Canada as a way to sort of force our hand, our issue, I think we have to separate out how the monetary system really functions. And there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of misunderstanding about how our monetary system really functions, because I don't think they even really teach it in the schools. I went to university at a time when you still got an education in neoclassical economics, and I don't know what they're being taught these days, but I don't know that they're getting the same kind of rigorous education that we did. So Canada is a monetary sovereign. Most people have probably at least heard that term. What does that mean? It's that the Canadian government has a monopoly in the production of Canadian dollars. It can never run out of Canadian dollars. And as long as is whatever debt it has is denominated in Canadian dollars, it can never run out of them. So what a Canadian government bond effectively is a different kind of Canadian money. And there's two ways in which the Canadian government can create money. One is it can simply spend it into existence. It can print a check and say, you want to build a bridge, here's the money. And they can literally create it out of thin air. That's what a fiat currency is. It's not tethered to anything. Now, when they say, we collected $400 billion in taxes last year, we plan on spending $450 billion in taxes this year. So we have a $50 billion deficit between taxes and anticipated expenditures. And they say, okay, so then what we'll do is we'll issue $50 billion in Canadian bonds, government bonds, to make up the difference. They don't have to do that. They could simply create the money out of thin air if they wanted. But they do it because it creates an interest-earning form of Canadian dollars that investors would want to hold, might want to hold. So it's simply a different kind of Canadian money, Canadian dollar, government-issued money. Our trading partners may wish to hold Canadian bonds because, as a hedge, they might want to hold these bonds in case when they need to, say, buy something from Canada, and they can easily then sell those bonds. And then you have another kind of money that's called bank money. This is private money. Now, this is sort of the deepest, darkest secret that economists don't seem to know or understand, or at least won't talk about, but bankers certainly do, is that banks create money too, subject to the reserve requirements, which is what deposits or equity they have on hand. Banks can create money every time they issue a loan. And the way it works is like this. Is, let's suppose a bank has a reserve requirement of 10% and I put $1 million in their bank. So the way that the money multiplier theory works, which is what they teach in the schools, which is not actually how it works, they can keep $100,000 back and loan out the other $900,000, but that's not what they do. They leave my $1 million in the bank and they issue $9 million in loans. And where'd that money come from? They created it out of thin air. And what's in fact occurred in economies in over the last 20 or 30 years is there's been a shift in a balance between government money and private money, or bank money. And the outcome of that has been much, much higher debt loads on the part of households and non-financial corporations. And that's why we have debt bubbles, and that's why we have housing bubbles. Is because we've given control of the monetary system over to the bankers. And ultimately, if you ask me, what is the Great Reset all about? Ultimately, the system crashed, and the people that crashed it want to retain control of the system.
Is inflation a big concern?
Absolutely. If you increase the money supply, but it does not end, which is what they've done through these CERB programs and a variety of other programs, so effectively printing money, but that money does not go into productive investment, so you're getting an increase in goods and services in your general economy that is more or less in equilibrium to how many new dollars you're pumping into that economy. Then you have more dollars chasing the same number, or in our case, quite likely fewer goods and services. So what happens when you've got more dollars chasing the same number of goods and services? The value, the price of those goods and services is bid up, and that's what inflation is.
Could Canada's housing bubble continue to grow?
It could, sure. It depends how much longer the central banks, since it's not just Canada, how much the central banks want to continue to support it. I think they've got themselves in a terrible situation because any government that allowed the housing bubble to pop under his watch would pay a terrible political price. So the question is can they ease their way out of it or not? I don't know. If there's a solution, I haven't heard it.
Could the election results affect the Canadian dollar?
Canada is a trading nation. Ultimately, the value of the Canadian dollar is a function of our trade position. I wouldn't worry about short-term fluctuations in the value of the Canadian dollar, because that could just be speculators messing around with the system, or somebody bailing out of a position, or just a bit of a herd mentality among investors. It's difficult to say. I think the question is going to be the overall health of the Canadian economy moving forward is going to be determining the position against other currencies, but which nations are in a better position than Canada economically?
Canada's a resource-rich country. If properly managed, could Canada be an economic powerhouse?
If Canadians knew how rich a country Canada is in natural resources, I think there'd probably be a fundamental change in our
political structure overnight. We are the only G7 country that is independent in energy. We have abundant fertile lands. We have a well-trained and well-educated workforce. The question is, where's all the money going? And who's it going to? And we don't have the same levels of wealth inequality and income inequality as observed in our southern neighbors. But there's definitely, excuse me, there's definitely been a trajectory in that direction over the ensuing decades. I think the reason why the Alberta Conservative government lost power to the NDP a few years ago in the province of Alberta had to do with a chart that was being distributed before that election that showed that Norway had pumped less oil than Alberta over the last 30 or 40 years, but that had a sovereign wealth fund approaching $1 trillion, and that the Alberta government was showing a deficit. Now, that is speaks to mismanagement of a very, very valuable natural resource.
Canada has high debt and high taxes. Is this a roadmap to serfdom?
Well, I think that digital passports are a roadmap to serfdom. Once again, we need to get back to into fundamental economics, which is unfortunately poorly understood, especially by economists. When a government taxes, what are they doing? What they're doing is they're withdrawing spending power from consumers and businesses. So what used to be called aggregate demand. And there's reasons why you tax, because people need to then use your currency in order to pay their taxes, to create, you know, markets for your currency and that sort of thing. So if the government is increasing taxes because it wants to take spending power away from you, which it then, using a formula, decides who then they redistribute money then to other areas of the economy. So fundamentally what governments are doing is picking winners and losers. They tax certain sectors and the general population, and then they decide who benefits from government largesse. This in some jurisdictions can be obviously a recipe for cronyism. The question is what's the right balance? If you are having inflationary pressures in an economy due to increasing wage rates, maybe because you have a shortage of workers and your economy is growing, then you might increase taxes, for example, to reduce spending power and aggregate demand to keep the pressure on prices lower. However, if you're in a recession or a depression and you increase taxes, you're only going to compound the depression.
Right now, who really runs Canada?
Heck of a question. The question to which nations like Canada are actually still governed by their own governments, and whether or not we're now increasingly required to, or where policy is being set by commitments made at the international level or supranational level, is a very good question. I think you have to look at the major financial centers in the world and the major financial powers in the world, and to what degree the economic fortunes of a nation are now in the hands of the central bankers rather than in the hands of the finance department of our country. There are very clearly very, very powerful people in Canada, but they don't typically operate in public in a way where you can see what they do. Most Canadians would be hard-pressed to tell you who the wealthiest family in Canada is. And that would be the Thomson family, or is it Thomson Reuters and Globe and Mail. Very few people would would know who Gordon M. Nixon is. And he's the chairman of the board of Bell, and he also sits on the management committee for the largest investment fund in the world, BlackRock, with $8 trillion, trillion with a T, under management. Before that, he was the chief executive officer, I believe, for the Royal Bank of Canada for many years. So there is a network, and it is very much an international network of people operating primarily in the financial sector, but also in big tech. And they attend conferences and meetings in Aspen and Davos, and they discuss things. And very often what they discuss and agree on at these international conferences ends up being what domestic policy is for many countries, including Canada.
Is climate change what we used to call weather?
There are two issues, and this is how I prefer to approach it. So there's no question that climate change is the greatest challenge facing us today. However, that challenge can be broken into two parts. One part is there is an environmental crisis. We are cutting down rainforests to grow soybeans. And forests are the greatest carbon sinks on the planet. The oceans have become acidified and killing off marine life. There is still ongoing destruction and pollution of the environment, and it is something that a lot of people feel very strongly about. But there's another part of the climate change agenda that is, in my view, a political crisis. And that it's a political crisis that's resulted from the fact that much of the discussions about the need for moving towards basically net zero carbon by 2050 and 2030 kind of being where they want to hit a few of the major benchmarks in terms of getting to net zero by 2050, is that countries like Canada are being asked to radically reduce their energy footprint. And the problem with that is energy is a proxy for economic activity. So what that effectively means is you're going to shrink the size of your economy. Meanwhile, the largest carbon emitter on the planet is China. According to a report I read from 2017, China's carbon emissions are in the range of 11 million tons a year. Now, that is more carbon emissions than the United States, the EU, Japan, and Canada combined. Canada's emissions at that time, I think, were just under 700,000 tons of carbon. So what I don't know, and here's the critical thing, is that China has made no commitments to reduce its carbon emissions. In fact, it has stated it plans on building more coal-fired electricity plants all through the decade. So there's a bit of sort of inconsistency, if I perhaps even incoherence, in terms of what they're saying to us. And I want to know what the plan is moving forward before I sign on to anything. One are we being asked to effectively shrink the size of our economy so that China can continue to build out theirs? Because if that's the plan, then I don't like the plan.
Why is there a push for digital ID and digital currency?
Because if the current monetary system collapses because of too much debt and leverage in the system, and they go to a central bank digital currency, they're going to have to be able to verify and authenticate who you are. And if we're moving into a period of steep economic decline, a great many people are going to be very unhappy, and they're going to need to have a way to control hostile, unhappy domestic populations whose lives have been utterly ruined in the prospects for the future. Those could be a couple of the reasons, but I haven't been invited to the planning meetings.
Klaus Schwab, sometimes referred to as Dr. Evil from the Austin Powers movies and his World Economic Forum, are they a concern for Canada's well-being and sovereignty?
Only as far as our political leaders are prepared to cede our sovereignty to them.
Is election fraud a concern?
Nothing is impossible, but I see nothing to indicate to me that it is a concern.
The mainstream media is ignoring the People's Party as much as they can in this election. Is the mainstream media the enemy of the people?
No, the mainstream media works for the people who pay, who write their checks, and they're doing as they're told. They're controlled, and in they've been given an agenda, and if they weren't prepared, journalists weren't prepared to abide by that agenda, they wouldn't have jobs.
Brad, how can people follow you and find out more about your campaign?
Well, if you go to, once again, my Twitter feed, where I have a very large archive of material that I posted up from my research over the past 18 months, and on my account page, you'll find a link to my candidates page, and that will tell you a little bit more about me in terms of my professional background. And in addition, there'll be a link there where you can send me an email if you want to get a hold of me. You can also follow me on Twitter, and if you follow me on Twitter and I follow you back, then we can also communicate via direct messaging off the Twitter account, which, given how hectic things are right now with my campaign, might be the preferred approach, is look me up on Twitter.
Brad, thank you so much for being on The Goddard Report.
Pleasure being here with you today.
My guest has been Brad Nickerson. He's running for the People's Party of Canada in the riding of Burnaby North Seymour. You can find him on Twitter at bnickerson12. I'm Jim Goddard. You can listen to us on Facebook, Talk Digital Network, and YouTube. Our Twitter account is at Talk Digital Network.
Comments made on The Goddard Report and TalkDigitalNetwork.com are an expression of opinion only. The Goddard Report is available online and mobile at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. The Goddard Report is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.